The Comic Book Time Machine Podcast, exploring comic books past, present, and future. Episode 6, Star Wars Begins, Marvel Sci-Fi, cover date July 1977. Hello, and welcome back to the Comic Book Time Machine, a podcast about going back in time to find and read good comics. Because, you know, if you have a time machine, sure, you could go and find out what happened to Amelia Earhart, or you could read about Machine Man in the pages of 2001 A Space Odyssey, or maybe the final episode of Logan's Run, which wasn't meant to be the final episode of Logan's Run, but was. Or, well, the topic that I'm most excited about, and the reason I'm actually doing this experiment, Star Wars. Yes, that's right. This is the episode where we finally get to talk about that first issue, cover date July 1977, of Star Wars, Marvel Comics adaptation of the 20th Century Fox movie. So I think I really just think we should just jump right in. I'm going to explain what this experiment is for people who are just joining. Basically, what I'm going to be doing from here on out with my solo experiment is I'm going to be reading through Marvel's sci-fi licensed books. And eventually that's going to get us into things like ROM and Micronauts and Star Trek and things like that. But I'm using Star Wars as the linchpin. I'm starting with Star Wars Issue 1. Last time I did a solo episode, it was talking about 2001 by Jack Kirby and the first issue of John Carter, Warlord of Mars, and Logan's Run. Because those three books, they started before Star Wars, but they ran concurrently with Star Wars when Star Wars began. Well, sort of ran concurrently with Star Wars, as you'll see in one example. And honestly, if it hadn't been for John Carter, I might have considered skipping them altogether, but they do fit into the thing here, as I think I ended my last time, my last solo episode, talking about the way Star Wars changed science fiction, and talking about how, you know, 2001 A Space Odyssey, along with Planet of the Apes, kind of changed, allowed movies in the genre of sci-fi to be a little more thoughtful and thought-provoking and not so much for just the kids. And with Star Wars, there was another big paradigm shift. And so what we're looking at here is we're seeing 2001 and Logan's Run. 2001 being, like I said, the beginning, and Logan's Run kind of being the end of that new sci-fi era. Because Logan's Run came out right before a little movie called Star Wars. So, like I said, though, I'd like to get started. I have a lot to talk about with Star Wars, John Carter, Logan's Run, 2001, all that kind of thing. So right now, I think we're going to go ahead and jump in with Part 1. Part 1, a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. Star Wars, issue number 1, cover date July 1977. I'm going to throw out a couple dates here. Though the first date being May 25th, 1977, it was a day that changed science fiction, changed cinema, changed fandom, changed the whole idea of franchises, changed, you could even argue, it changed pop culture. It definitely altered my young life. But the thing is, Star Wars actually started changing comics even before that date in May 25th, 1977. Cover date, July 77. The first issue of Star Wars was actually released April 12th, 1977, according to Mike's Amazing World of Comics. Issue number 1 was the first chapter of the Star Wars adaptation, the first of 6 chapters. They were, remember Logan's Run started out with 4 and then turned into 5. Well, Star Wars is going to go ahead and just jump right in and be 6. With a 30-cent cover price, The issue is a treasure for fans of Star Wars, especially early on. And when I say the issue is a treasure, I'm not talking about the resale price, you know, when you, you know, try and sell your collection or something like that. If you have that issue, it's gonna get you some money. But I'm talking about it being a treasure to fans back then. There were extra scenes in there, deleted scenes. Now they would show up on a DVD if the filmmakers weren't too embarrassed by them. But back then, there was no way to see this kind of thing. Now, this isn't unusual, though, because Star Wars was no different than any other adaptation. A lot of times, the adaptation of a movie into a book or a comic book required an early draft of the script, and sometimes the script would change between the time that the people who were doing the adaptation would get it and when the movie was actually filmed and then released. And so I think specifically of Star Trek V, which had some stuff in it that was not in the actual screened movie because they didn't have budget to do the things that they wanted to do, and so they had to actually make some changes. Well, in the comic book, they didn't have time to change it. It was already getting drawn and being printed. The same thing happened with Superman 4. I remember that comic book. I really enjoyed the Superman 4 comic book, and it had a cut scene in there with a strange dark-haired clone of Superman instead of the blonde-haired clone of Superman named Nuclear Man. In Superman 4, The Quest for Peace comic book, I really, really loved it because it had these extra things in it that weren't in the movie. And the comic book's pretty good, by the way. The movie, another topic for another day, but the comic book actually wasn't too bad. So the same thing here was happening with Star Wars because they were adapting from a script and things were changing before the movie was finished. And but they were actually adapting this before they had ever seen anything on the big screen. They were adapting these things before, you know, based on photo references and based on a movie screening that we'll talk about in a moment here. But before we talk about the actual story that we find within the comic, we should probably just talk about the story of the comic. So where did it start? Well, the first stop. George Lucas was making Star Wars with 20th Century Fox, and he took some risks, and 20th Century Fox was taking some risks with George Lucas. So the story says that George Lucas actually came to Stan Lee, and the legend has it, and by legend I mean Jim Shooter's blog, which I'll link to in the show notes for this episode, which can be found at comicbooktimemachine.com/StarWarsBegins. In the show notes, though, you'll find a link to Jim Shooter's story about how he believes that he heard Stan Lee kept George Lucas waiting 45 minutes in reception of his office and then turned them down, their idea of a comic book to help drum up interest for the movie because they wanted to have some issues of the Star Wars comic book come out a couple months before the movie was released. They didn't have a whole bunch of things where they were doing a bunch of publicity and stuff like that for this first Star Wars movie. And this was going to be one of those few publicity things that they were going to do. So we're in early 1976, and they came back to Marvel, but this time they came through Roy Thomas. Now, Roy Thomas was once editor-in-chief. He is well known and well-loved in fan circles as a writer for Marvel Comics in the 70s. His work on Conan and The Invaders were two of his biggest things back then. At the time, though, that they came to him, he was not editor-in-chief anymore. He was merely a writer and editor on staff or freelancing. And they insisted on him doing the Star Wars comic book, and they wanted him. They came to him, and they said they came to him because of Conan, because what he'd done with Conan. And what had he done with Conan? Well, he made Conan an awesome comic book. He made it one of their biggest books. They actually had Conan Power Records. I remember an album that I had. I didn't have the record album. I had a CD, but it was Spider-Man, Rock Reflections of a Superhero. And it had all these pictures of Marvel superheroes doing stuff with different instruments. And one of the people that they had in this in the liner notes was Conan. He wasn't a superhero. I don't know if they had to like go through a time warp to bring him, you know, into the future so that he could play instruments in Spider-Man's band as they were doing the Spider-Man Rock Reflections of a Superhero. By the way, I recommend the album. Spider-Man Rock Reflections of a Superhero is It is cheese. It is kitschy at its best. I'm not going to get into all these things, but it's basically just rock songs about Spider-Man stories. And at one point, Dr. Octopus has his own song, his own rock anthem. And in it, he's putting down all the other superheroes and stuff. And one of the superheroes he puts down is, he says, "Conan, you're going to be no man when I'm done with you," that kind of thing. So anyway, Conan was huge. It was big, and it was making lots of money for Marvel. And so the way Roy Thomas says it, he did an article about the beginnings of Star Wars comic books. And the way he says that it worked was the success and quality of the Conan titles. This is a direct quote. "The success and quality of the Conan titles were the double reasons that they approached him." Now, Stan Lee had said no, and Roy Thomas wasn't interested because he had dealt with studio interference on other projects, Planet of the Apes being one of them. And with Conan, he was okay because Robert E. Howard was dead and couldn't complain because they did a lot of original material about Conan. But they started telling him the story of Star Wars, and he still wasn't interested because they were just using... There's all these words coming at him, Obi-Wan Kenobi, Chewbacca, and all those kind of things. Just wasn't interested. And then they started showing him the concept art. And so in this article that I was reading that he had written, he's explaining the concept art and how it just grabbed him. And that's where he knew this was going to be cool. This was going to go back to the space opera stuff of the comic books that he loved from, you know, the 50s and that kind of thing. You know, they couldn't do that kind of thing on the screen. They couldn't do it well. And so this is a real change for him. He's looking at this and saying, yes, I like this. I could enjoy this. I want to do this. So they had the writer that they wanted. Roy was in as the writer. And the artist they wanted was Howard Chaykin, who is, you know, one of the greats. When you look at comic book artists, he's right up there. He's one of the greats. And they wanted him because of some work he had done on a sci-fi series for DC called Iron Wolf. And so they were interested in him, and Howard ended up being interested in the book. All they needed was Stan Lee. So step one was George Lucas going to Stan Lee. Step two was a man named Charlie Lippincott going to Roy Thomas. And step three was Roy Thomas going to Stan Lee. And Stan said yes, and the reasons are dubious. Roy Thomas doesn't really know, and Stan Lee said it was something about when they first came to him, they didn't mention that Alec Guinness was going to be in it, but when Roy Thomas mentioned that Alec Guinness was going to be in it, that was what sold them on it. But Roy Thomas doesn't really believe that. So he wanted to do it in 6 issues after he saw the screenplays and started getting into the artwork and everything like that. And they were pushing for fewer. Marvel was pushing for fewer because Marvel is looking at this as saying, you know, this is, who knows what this Star Wars is? No one knows what Star Wars is. It's got a really lame name. It's, why would we, you know, want Star Wars? And so they were suggesting maybe 2 issues or maybe even doing it in one. 20th Century Fox, their biggest thing was they wanted 2 issues out before the movie came out. And so if they had done the adaptation in 2 issues, it would be done. They wouldn't have to worry about anything more, and their obligation would be finished if the movie was a flop. But Roy, he strong-armed them. He wanted 6 issues, and he was their man, and so he got 6 issues. So, like I said, they got to look at concept art. Roy Thomas actually got to go into Industrial Light and Magic and actually see the models of the vehicles and see, you know, the trench run for the Death Star and all those kind of things. He got to see these, he called them model kits. He thought they looked like model kits. He also got to see the legendary screening. And this is a cut of Star Wars that didn't have all the special effects. You had, this is the cut of Star Wars that had actually, instead of TIE fighters and X-Wing fighters, they cut in World War II footage. So like the scene where they're escaping the Death Star and Han and Luke are both, you know, shooting the guns from the Millennium Falcon. And as they're shooting, they'd show Luke, you know, firing his weapon at the various TIE fighters that were coming at them. And instead of a TIE fighter, they'd cut to a World War II plane getting shot. And And so these were this was something that he got to sit in on, and he didn't know until later that he was actually sitting in on something really important. In his article, he actually says he didn't realize that this was the legendary screening that, you know, fans talk about until 2006, when someone was interviewing him and asked him about it. One thing, though, that he did notice is that there were things that were different that they had cut out that had been in the screenplay that he was using. And so artwork was already finished. And the way he says it, when he went and saw the screening, they were actually sending these books to the printing press. And with these books, the artwork is done. And he's sitting there watching this movie and seeing, oh, all the stuff in Tatooine from issue one is gone. The screen crawl, the famous beginning, it's different. From Roy Thomas got an early draft, and then he noticed, oh, the screen crawl at the beginning, they changed it. But honestly, it's okay. I don't mind those differences, because what we're really getting here is a nice look behind the curtain in the filmmaking process and how editing works, even after they've already filmed things. So it makes it an interesting comparison to see, you know, this is what it was before and this is what it became after. And sometimes it's for the best, and sometimes not so much. The issue itself, though, turning back to this issue one, it sold really well. Now, we'll talk about issue two next time, which also came out before the movie. But issue one sold incredibly well. They were very pleased with how well it sold. So long as the movie didn't bomb, they would do very well with this investment, because they didn't really have to pay much. I think that the royalties to George Lucas on this adaptation, the royalties were close to zero. They were not paying very much to actually produce these books. And usually, as you'll note when we talk about Edgar Rice Burroughs later on, there is money that gets paid to the people who own the license and people who own the copyright. In this case, for Star Wars, because they wanted to use these comic books as something that would help drum up interest in the movie, they were more willing to let the license go for a sweet little song. So the issue did well. Part of the reason the issue did well was because of Howard Chaykin's art. There's no doubt about that, because it does have a vibrancy and an energy. And of course, they weren't able to at that point, when issue one first came out, they weren't able to compare it to the movie. Now, one other thing is this comic, issue number one of Star Wars, is said to be one of the most reprinted comics ever, and it's actually, you know, sold millions of copies if you include all of the collections and stuff that it's been reprinted in. Another reason why it sold well was because there was fan buzz. Now, there wasn't internet back then, obviously, but there were fan circles, there were comic book fan circles. Comic conventions were actually about comic books. And one of the things that they did was they took Star Wars in July 1976 to San Diego Comic-Con. And this is one of, if not the first movie presentation at San Diego Comic-Con. And Roy Thomas regrets now that they started it. But at San Diego Comic-Con, July 1976, Charlie Lippincott, who I mentioned before, Roy Thomas and Howard Chaykin did a panel presenting at least a poster artwork that Howard Chaykin had drawn for Star Wars. They had t-shirts there. They were selling the posters for $1. They were selling the t-shirts, I believe. These things, if you bought that poster for $1 and still have it in good condition, you made a great investment back in 1976. The response to that presentation was very, very enthusiastic and very, very positive. And Roy Thomas credits that with a lot of the success for that first issue of Star Wars. Because remember, they didn't have a big, big push behind the Star Wars movie. So they didn't have a big, big push behind the Star Wars comic book. In fact, the big push behind the Star Wars movie was the Star Wars comic book. So they weren't riding on the popularity of the movie yet. The movie was not popular yet. That was still a couple months out. So, taking a look at this issue from a critical standpoint, it's hard to be critical of it because, like I said, Howard Chaykin, he had seen stills, he had seen pictures, he had seen models, but he had not seen things in action when they were actually drawing and creating this comic. this issue was already going to print by the time they saw that movie presentation in July of 1976. So, if you're looking through, like I'm doing right now, you're seeing on that first page with that screen crawl that's different. You see a Death Star. You see a Star Destroyer. It does not look like the Star Destroyer. It's triangle. There is that triangleness to it, but it just is not on model. And that's one thing that as I'm looking through here, I'm just noticing there are a lot of things that just aren't on model. One thing that really is on model is C-3PO, interestingly. The problem is you can tell that they've never seen C-3PO moving because you can see he is much more flexible, much more active. He's able to hop around. He's able to jump slightly. I mean, he's not doing, you know, aerobics or anything like that, but there are a couple panels of C-3PO where he is moving in ways that just don't feel right to me. Now, they don't feel right to me because I've spent decades with this movie, decades with this character. Howard Chaykin had seen photographs of it and read a screenplay. So it's understandable. Some of the character likenesses don't work. I don't feel like I'm looking at Mark Hamill as I look at this, but I do feel like I'm looking at Luke Skywalker, and I don't know if I'm more forgiving with that kind of thing because I've also spent time reading Star Wars comic books. The one thing I do want to mention here is this is actually, after this trip back in time on the comic book time machine, it's the first time I actually ever read this issue of Star Wars. I never felt the desire to go and seek it out because, honestly, I already know the story of Star Wars. I know that movie's story very, very, very well. Also on model are the Sand People, which is where this issue ends, where Luke is being attacked by the Sand People. Luke Skywalker, Princess Leia, C-3PO, R2-D2, and Darth Vader are really the only primary cast who appear in this issue. Yeah, there's Stormtroopers and Jawas and Sand People and Biggs Darklighter, which we'll talk about him in a moment here. But it's interesting because it does not get very far, or doesn't feel like it gets very far, because we don't even get to Obi-Wan Kenobi. Now, we do end at a good cliffhanger. As someone who has written adaptations before, especially George Martin's Hedge Knight, where I had six issues to do his novella, I had to do the first two books looking for at least what I would call an emotional cliffhanger to bring people back in the next issue. That is not easy. And so with this, you have it ends with a sand person raising his staff to strike Luke Skywalker, and it says, "Next issue, on to Alderaan." It ends in a very dramatic place. Now, there's only 16 pages of story, so it does feel kind of short. And some things are glossed over. So it's interesting because you do get these deleted scenes from Tatooine that really give us some of the quiet moments of Luke Skywalker's life before his aunt and uncle get killed and he has to go with Obi-Wan Kenobi. We get those quiet moments, but then we also get a lot of quick moments that you just are thinking, well, wait a minute, did that even happen? The famous scene of Princess Leia recording the message for Obi-Wan Kenobi, where you hear her, you know, "Help me, Obi-Wan Kenobi, you're my only hope." And then she looks around and she inserts the disc into R2-D2. It's just one panel. And so, but again, I've done adaptations of various stories for different people, and that's hard. It's hard to figure out how do you pace this? How do you make it work? One problem that you have happening here is, now when you're going from a novel to a comic book, it's especially bad, but when you're going from a screenplay and it hasn't been edited yet to see how well it's paced for the screen, they haven't had a chance to sit down and make sure the story was going to move, you know, faster, more intense. They don't know how it's going to play yet. So they have a screenplay that has some quiet scenes, and it's nice. I like that. I like that a lot, that they get to have those moments in there. One more thing I'll say about these moments, though, is that, first of all, these moments being in the issue makes that a significant portion of the 16 pages. So the focus on this chapter of this book is on Luke Skywalker, squarely on Luke Skywalker. Clearly, Luke Skywalker is the main character of the Star Wars comic book that we're going to be reading, because he's the only heroic character that we get in this entire issue. along with that, you have those deleted scenes of Luke talking to his friend, Biggs. Biggs is going to go off. And we do meet Biggs in the end of the Star Wars movie where they're going to attack the Death Star. We meet him. Luke Skywalker says things that make you think that he might know him, but in the movie, the way it's cut, we never find out, you know, how the relationship works. Biggs is going to leave, and so we get the scene, and we get some scenes of Luke talking to his buddies, trying to tell them about how he saw a battle or something like that up in space. It's very interesting to me because those scenes, they are in the Star Wars storybook. Like I said, I mentioned seeing photos and pictures of things that weren't in the movie. That scene of Luke talking to Biggs, I remember vividly seeing that. And I remember it vividly because it wasn't in the movie. It was in the storybook that I had, though. It was on the record. It was in the radio adaptation. It was in the novel. It's here in the comic book. You know the only place that these scenes aren't? The special editions of the movies. Like here, when I heard that he was doing special editions and adding in special effects and some deleted scenes, and we're going to get the scene where Han is talking to Jabba the Hutt, and oh, great, great, great. I'm hoping that we're going to get to see these quiet scenes of Luke's life before he leaves Tatooine. Do we get them in the special editions? No, we get everything else. Many things we weren't even asking for in the special editions, but we don't get Luke Skywalker talking to his buddy. That's what I wanted. That's the only thing I wanted. To quote my friend Daniel, I don't ask for much. It's the only thing I'm asking for. That and a warm blanket. Finally, I mentioned the coffee cup, and I'm very, very excited to talk about the coffee cup. When I was first starting this podcast, and I was talking to people about the Star Wars comic book adaptation, I had a couple different people, including my friend Daniel Butcher, who you might know from a little podcast called Welcome to Level 7, a blog called Between Disney, and another little podcast called Comic Book Time Machine. They brought up a scene in the comic where, I'm just going to have to explain it to you. It's the scene in the Death Star boardroom where all of the Imperial officers are sitting around that table. They're talking about things. Tarkin has just announced that the Emperor has dissolved the Senate, and Vader is talking to some of the Imperial officers about the Death Star, and he, as he's talking to them, casually uses the Force to bring a cup of steaming liquid, possibly coffee, maybe hot cocoa, maybe he's a tea type of person. I like to imagine that he's getting a nice cup of hot chocolate. The cup, it looks like a styrofoam cup. It's white. There's steam coming up. And it goes and floats into his hand just before he force chokes that one guy for his lack of faith, which Darth Vader finds disturbing. One person I talked to thought it might have even been a mistake. Possibly the inker was inking the page and got to that point where Darth Vader's hand is out and it looks like, you know, he's strangling the guy from afar, and so his hand looks like it's supposed to be holding something, and the inker maybe thought that Howard Chaykin forgot to put a cup in his hand, and so, well, how am I going to get a cup into his hand? I know, I'll just make it float to him. Or what's the deal here? Well, let me tell you what the deal is. I have a book, and this is one of my favorite Star Wars books. I never really got into the Star Wars Expanded Universe. I read a couple of the novels, but they just didn't draw me in the way Star Trek Expanded Universe did. And I don't know exactly what the difference was between Star Wars novels and Star Trek novels. But I have a book called Star Wars The Annotated Screenplays. And this book has the three screenplays for Star Wars, A New Hope, The Empire Strikes Back, and Return of the Jedi. And there's tons and tons and tons and tons of notes. One thing it does is it does a parallel screenplay where when it gets to a point that was changed for the special edition, there would be you'd see the original and the special edition side by side. And then there's lots of notes and quotes from different people, including George Lucas, about changes to the screenplay from the earliest drafts to the shooting scripts. Very interesting things. Very interesting book. It's Laurent Bourzeau. I'll put a link in the show notes to the book. And he actually explains what is happening here. It's very, very interesting. I don't even Well, let's just go ahead. The scene in the conference room of the Death Star that introduces Grand Moff Tarkin, Commander Tag, and Admiral Modi first appeared in the fourth draft. The exchange between Modi, and Vader is different from the scene in the film. During the meeting, Vader stirs slightly, and a metal cup mysteriously floats into his hands. Vader tries to strangle Modi without touching him, and after he releases him, he crumples the metal cup with the Force. So there it is. It was actually going to be in the movie. It did not end up in the movie, but it was going to be in the movie. And that's from page 39 of Star Wars, the annotated screenplays. Like I said, it's a great book. I love this resource. Again, giving you a peek behind the curtain that you really can't get in any other places. So, the issue. Issue number one, was it worth going back in time to find it? Yes, it was worth going back in time to read issue number one of Star Wars, and I'm even more excited to continue. I'm a little disappointed that I'm going to have to wait five more issues before I get into new material. I'm going to be reading their adaptation of existing material that I'm very, very familiar with already. But this comic book is the reason for this experiment in time. Tons and tons of licensing opportunities came to Marvel because of what Roy Thomas did here with Star Wars. People wanted to replicate the success that Star Wars had, and part of that success was the Star Wars comic book. And obviously it wasn't going to be duplicated exactly with what happened with Star Wars. You'll see another success in Transformers and G.I. Joe, but Transformers and G.I. Joe are two titles I'm not going to get into. They are possibly two of the most important other licenses. Star Wars, G.I. Joe, and Transformers are kind of the trifecta. I'm not going to get into those. I'm going to stick with the other stuff. Transformers and G.I. Joe both went well beyond Star Wars. When Star Wars issue 107 came along, final issue, Transformers and G.I. Joe continued going, and I'm stopping with the end of Star Wars. I'm not going to go beyond that with this particular experiment. This is also the beginning of the Star Wars expanded universe, although not really until issue 7 of the series do we start expanding the Star Wars universe, but this is the first beginning where we're going to see other people add other things to the Star Wars universe. Some of this obviously is not canon. In fact, I think that as far as expanded universe canon went before the big announcement that the new movies were going to go off, you know, so episode 7 is not going to hold to the expanded universe novels and video games and everything that have come out since Return of the Jedi. So that the movies are their own things and the expanded universe novels are not part of that. And I believe that the Star Wars comic books weren't automatically part of the canon. It doesn't matter to me. I'm excited to read through these Star Wars comics because they are their own canon. Issue 1 through issue 107 plus the annuals, they are their own thing, and I'm really excited about diving into this. And because I didn't really get into the novels, I don't really care that episode 7 is not going to get into whatever happened with Luke and Han and Leia, even though I heard there were some really interesting things that went on with them. So, it was worth going back in time, well worth the 30 cents I didn't pay when I went back in time in my imaginary time machine. So, I think on that note, we are going to move to part 2 of this trip through time. Part 2, Final Run, Logan's Run, number 7. So, as you might remember if you listened to my last episode about the experiment, Logan's Run issue 6 left me, ambivalent. I liked the story of the movies, and I liked where the movie went. So after the movie, where do you go after that? Well, where do you go? You have to pick the primary bad guys, maybe, and the primary bad guys of the movie were the killers, the Sandmen, and the children. So issue 6 left me cold. I felt like it was treading water, literally, as I think Logan was swimming through some sewage ducts kind of thing. I really had no desire to see the next story. So the question is, Would issue 7 leave me wanting more? Or would I even care that there was never going to be an issue number 8? Issue number 7 was written by John David Warner. It was edited by Archie Goodwin. The theme of Logan's run, I think the theme throughout the movie and not so much the TV series, probably a couple episodes of the TV series, is a generation gap. And it's interesting, you know, I don't exactly know how this world works when you have the children who are feral and growing up in some sort of no man's land that they called Cathedral. And actually the Cathedral being one of the overt religious concepts of the movie. So you have the uneducated children living in a church, living a life of violence and anger. And then when you get old enough, you know, I guess you graduate into the nihilistic hedonism of the domed city. And then at 30, you're euthanized. Interesting. You know, I just thought that, you know, they're actually euthanized in their youth. So anyway, In this issue, then, the dome has fallen, the computers are dead, the people who are under 15, or whatever age that was, they are now taking control. And meanwhile, the young adult population between 15 and 30, whoever was left, they are just trying to figure out how to survive and how to live without the computers helping their every move. Now, one thing I found interesting is I did feel like these young people... there has to be reference to that one episode of Star Trek where the children are, you know, there's a disease and anyone who finally gets to adulthood, they die. And so these kids, they have these chants and stuff. And so when the crew from the Enterprise comes, they're chanting while they're beating up Captain Kirk, that kind of thing. There's a chant even in this one that's city people lie, city people die, that kind of thing. And so... the question is, like I said, does number 7 work? Well, issue number 7 works better than issue number 6. That, I would say. But not by much, because I still feel like the stakes are undefined. I don't know what this new storyline is going to be. Last issue, I felt like the writers didn't even know what it was going to be. But the stakes, I feel like there's no stakes, or at least they're undefined. A disembodied voice is giving directions to a Sandman who is supposed to be Logan's new antagonist. And reading it, I still feel like they're still treading water. They're just not doing anything new. They're leaving the characters in the city. Like I said, there's just no stakes. The world of Logan's Run comic book is just so dang small. I wouldn't mind reading more set in this world. There is potential in the concept of Logan's Run, even if you're just, you know, coming off the end of that movie. But there was no more in issue number 7. I feel like issue number 7 is just continuing the ending from issue number 5. Even though issue number 8 was promised, I feel like we're looking at the last one. Now, there were, at this point, contract problems with MGM. And I don't know exactly what, but if in back issue number 34... Perez actually says, unfortunately, they continued the comic book without getting all the I's dotted and the T's crossed regarding the license. So that is kind of interesting. But cover date July 77 was also release date of April 19th, 1977, according to Mike's Amazing World of Comics. And September 16th, 1977, a few days shy of 6 months after Logan's final run on the comic spinner racks, Logan's Run was on the small screen. And so a lot of people suspect that because MGM was doing the TV show, they didn't want a competing story. Not necessarily competing for people's pocketbooks or whatever, but competing story, because Logan's Run, the TV show, they reimagined the movie and they continue from a different point. So now the TV show is available on DVD. And so if you go to comicbooktimemachine.com/Logan or comicbooktimemachine.com/Amazon, you can get the TV show. Like I said, they reimagined the movie without the ending of the city. Instead, Logan and Jessica, they are looking for the promised land, basically. But they're going around outside the city. Sometimes they go back inside. And they go where I hoped the comic would go. They go outside and they explore the world. There's a new place in every episode, a new mystery in every episode, a new allegory in every episode. It's from the 70s. It's cheesy. And I really enjoyed it. Okay, there's only 14 episodes. The TV show was not a success at all. And in fact, some people think that the TV show actually came from MGM saying, "Oh, Star Wars. What do we have that could capitalize on the success of this crazy movie that's awesome and everybody loves?" I don't know what really was going on there, but if you enjoy original Star Trek and if you enjoy classic Doctor Who, you will enjoy Logan's Run, the TV show. So anyway, as far as this issue of the comic goes, I have no problem that this was canceled. And I have no... In fact, I'm actually kind of glad. If this was canceled to make way for the TV show, great. I loved the TV show. I enjoyed it in a campy 1970s way. And I'll be honest, I like the TV show a lot more than I like the comic book. So my recommendation when it comes to Logan's Run, now that we're at the end of the run, my recommendation, Logan's Run comic adaptation of the movie, issues 1 through 5. Those are worth tracking down. And for fans of the movie and for fans of science fiction, issue 6 and 7 to me have very little value story wise. The only value that you would get from issue 6 is honestly that Thanos story. Some pencil pages, penciled by Tom Sutton for issue number 9, have shown up. So apparently, issue 8 and possibly even issue 9 were written and created. And Logan does return to Marvel. Now, there were other Logan's Run comic books, but Logan did return to Marvel for one more run. This is probably a fill-in issue. This is not the Tom Sutton stuff, and it's not the issue 8 stuff. Probably a fill-in issue that they had just in case there was a missed deadline in the Logan's Run comic itself. Archie Goodwin wrote it. Michael Golden and Steve Mitchell did the art. And they actually printed this in Bizarre Adventures, and they changed names, they changed some of the artwork, but to people in the know, it exists. And so this actually, the Logan's Run that they did that's not actually Logan's Run, I might have to explore it for my experiment. But that's not for years, but it does fall into the dates that I will be working with, so you never know, I might be returning to Logan's Run in the future. And if so, I hope it's better than what I got with issue 6 and 7. The TV show, though, it was what I wanted the comic book to be. So that leads us to chapter 3. Part 3, The Machine Man. 2001, A Space Odyssey, number 8. So when we last left the year 2001 or so, because some of the issues actually don't even take place in 2001, but that's another story, the Monolith and the Space Baby revealed their purpose, and that's great. That issue finally revealed to us what Jack Kirby was thinking. Or did it? Because we now have an 8th issue of Jack Kirby 2001 fan fiction. Okay, I call it fan fiction. I am not insulting fan fiction by calling it. This is just Jack Kirby doing what fan fiction is, giving his interpretation of a property that he really enjoyed. The difference is he actually got to work with the license and hold the license with Marvel. So anyway, in a circular Chariot of the Gods sort of move, the Monolith creates the Space Baby. The Space Baby observes life and then plants life for the Monolith to come and create space babies from. It's a graphic novel. So far we have 3 parts to Jack Kirby's 2001 fan fiction. Part 1 is the movie adaptation. I really recommend that. I've already talked about why, but I recommend the movie adaptation. If you can get your hands on it, it is, like I said, a treasure in my collection. Part 2, the Kirby sequel to 2001. That is issues 1 through 7. I recommend issues 1 through 7 as a unit of story. It's Jack Kirby's interpretation of what the monolith means and what the space baby means, and reading all of them all together, yes, I do agree that when they said that you have to read it all together, they are right. Those 7 issues work well together in a crazy, offbeat, wild, funky 1970s science fiction Jack Kirby sort of way. Part 3 of the 2001 fan fiction starts here. Now, I want to make a note. So far, in all of these stories, we have not seen Hal and we have not seen Dave. They have not returned in Jack Kirby's material. Jack Kirby has only been bringing in the monolith, and he's only bringing in the monolith to create space babies. And that's what the monolith did to Dave. So that's why we aren't seeing Dave anymore. Hal, the computer, he was shut down. He was left, you know, circling Jupiter or whatever. We haven't seen Hal. So in this issue, well, in this issue, there's still no Hal. But there should be. Oh my goodness. This talk about missed opportunity. This issue, in a nutshell, this issue introduces 2 characters. Now, we learn from the title page that it's based on concepts of the MGM movie by Stanley Kubrick and Arthur C. Clarke. Edited, written, drawn by Jack Kirby. Lettered and inked by Michael Royer. Colored by Petra G. Overseer Archie Goodwin. Character number 1, we are told, this is the monolith with a new destiny to mold. Character number 2, this is what we're told. Again, quoting, is he a push-button man or a machine in search of a soul? Superheroes would pity him. Supervillains would scoff at him. Yet, he is a match for any of them. This is an odyssey to freedom. A journey for a name. For one who is only a number. And the title, The Capture of X-51. What? Superheroes? Okay, we did have some superhero stuff going on. And what was the issue? Issue 6, I think. Issue 5, 6. There was some superhero stuff going on, but oh my goodness. This is... Okay, so we're on to a whole nother style thing. So we end up with robots with existential crises. X-35 is actually the robot we're seeing on the splash page, even though it's talking about X-51. He says, I'm not a thing, but... What am I? What am I? He struggles and he fights. Why was I built? Why? Those are questions we all want to know, buddy. So maybe we're going to be getting an exploration of these kind of big idea questions that science and philosophy and religion try to answer. No. We're getting destruct codes. We're getting robots blowing up. 50, by the way. 50 robots blowing up. But not X-51, who is the 51st robot. You see, he is with Dr. Abel Stack. Yes, his name was Abel Stack. He is the robot son of Dr. Abel Stack. His name is Aaron. And Dr. Stack gave him a human face and raised him as a human. And actually... I'm kind of reminded of Rise of the Planet of the Apes, just because I have Planet of the Apes on my mind here. But we've seen this story before, okay? This is not a very original. Destruct codes blowing up the robots, you know, they're all these robots are having trouble. And so because of these existential crises, they decide to destroy all of them. X-51 is the last one. Abel removes the bomb, tells his robot son, get dressed. And then dresses him up as a robot superhero and sends him on his way. The bomb blows Abel away while Aaron flies into the world and he's causing panic all over the place and cartoonish and accidental chaos. And until the army catches him. They take away his face. They take away his power. They take away his humanity. We get to look at him as a robot, stripped away of all the human stuff that his father gave him. The way he's strapped down to a table, I'm reminded of a cross. It's almost like he's being crucified. We see the number X51 on his forehead. We hear a bunch of robot epithets thrown at him, like Junk Bucket and Steel Sting, and Steel Skin, rather. And that thing. And he starts having his existential crisis. So interesting. This story, it flirts with meaning. It flirts with big ideas. He's laying there. He's tied down. He can't get up. He doesn't have his great strength. He should be, you know, flying around, exploring the world. But so here's what he says. Here's his monologue. He says, he called me a machine, a junk bucket. But that's impossible. I think, I feel, I hurt inside. Oh, Lord, how I hurt inside. There's cries of why. He says that we're all brothers. And so so far we have this robot. I mean, he's actually kind of almost praying. You could say that he says, oh, Lord, you know, taking the Lord's name sort of thing. But you could also look at it as, you know, this is a robot crying out, oh, Lord, I hurt inside. But then he actually does kind of pray. He yells out, Dad! Why do they hate me? Why do they fear me? And then there's no answer. You know, his cries ring out, and suddenly we're just, he's alone in the universe. This very, it flirts with such great big ideas. And Kirby, he's close to it. He's almost there. The final page is just confounding to me. Again, I'm quoting, the cry rings ominously once again through the complex. But this time, a bright alien glow fills the cell in place of an answer. There is a gentle sound, like a song from the stars, and it calms the emotions of X-51. Okay. So, I said confounding. I'm using that word on purpose. Confounding point number one, the monolith. The monolith gives X-51 strength to pull away from his restraints and walk toward the monolith. Confounding point number two, artificial intelligence. This should be a riff on HAL. Jack Kirby could have gone back to the source, mentioned HAL, played with HAL, but instead, in the final panel, we get it's X-51. And it's maybe he just did this because he wanted to create a new character. I don't know. But what could have been? We get the final panel gives us the promise, next, get in on the ground floor and witness the birth of a superhero. Sigh. What could have been? Now, we still have next issue. There's still some possibilities for really getting into this. But this is part three of 2001 A Space Odyssey, a robot superhero created by the monolith. And artificial intelligence springing up and not related at all to HAL. Now remember, the monolith, my observation of the monolith is that the monolith comes to observe these changes in history, these epochs, these new eras that come from tool usage and that kind of thing. It's possible also that the monolith helps push along, you know, because that one... was a moon watcher in the movie and in the book and in the comic book. When he touches the monolith, that's when he gets the idea to use tools or to do things more than and differently than what they're doing. But HAL was a change. HAL was an artificial intelligence that actually got sentience, and the monolith, it could have tied in the monolith to this brand new life form of HAL, and Jack Kirby could have taken us back there. He didn't. Maybe next issue. I'm going to say probably not. I haven't read ahead. I'm not going to read ahead. This month, July 1977, I've read my four issues. 2001 A Space Odyssey number 8, Star Wars number 1, John Carter Warlord of Mars number 2, Logan's Run number 7. I have not read ahead in any of those four series. I have not looked ahead in my setup, the setup bags that I have. but I really doubt. Maybe, no. I want I want to read ahead, though. I do want to read ahead to find out, but I am not going to. So anyway, in this issue, we get some, I guess, decent pop, superhero, pulp, sci-fi stuff that skirts ideas. And actually, maybe I should give more benefit of doubt to Jack Kirby. In sci-fi comics from this period and before, big ideas, I've seen big ideas get flirted with, but honestly, usually it's pulp fiction that we're getting. It's pulp space fantasy rather than the big idea sci-fi. And so, yes, the fact that this is surface stuff and very little subtlety, I'm okay with that. I just am confounded because this is 2001. So anyway, that brings us to part four. Part four, Return to Mars. John Carter, Warlord of Mars, number two. So I'm going to talk a little bit about kind of a history of John Carter in comic books right now. John Carter began life as pulp sci-fi or pulp fantasy, romance fiction, whatever you want to call it. First appearing back in the teens, the 19 teens. I think 1912 was his first appearance in serialized magazine form. 1917, I think, is when they collected those first serials into The Princess of Mars, which was the first John Carter book. And the reason that they collected them was because of Tarzan's popularity. The John Carter books were collected because they wanted more stuff from this Edgar Rice Burroughs guy who had created this Tarzan character that was very, very popular. And so the John Carter books started with Princess of Mars. There were 11 total Mars books, Barsoom books or whatever they want to call them, because they aren't John Carter books. There are some books that, John Carter doesn't even figure into as a character. So the first appearance in comic form was in the 1940s. It was newspaper strips, and there was just a couple of years and just a couple of newspapers. But the reason that they did a John Carter newspaper strip was because they had done a Tarzan newspaper strip, and the Tarzan newspaper strip was popular enough that they wanted some more from this Edgar Rice Burroughs guy. In comic book form, Dell Comics published Tarzan from the 40s to the 70s, a long, long, long run of Tarzan comic books. And of course, you know, they wanted more from this Edgar Rice Burroughs guy, so they actually published, I think it was three issues of a John Carter comic, based on, what I read in, my research. My research being mainly being Wikipedia and Back Issue Magazine, number 55, which, by the way, I've mentioned Back Issue Magazine, I mentioned Roy Thomas's Alter Ego Magazine, they're both published by Tomorrow's Publishing. I highly, 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 highly recommend them. I'm getting a lot of information and a lot of just, you know, quotes from the source about these things, you know. And so you have, like I said, and I'm going to get into from Back Issue Magazine issue number 55, some things from Marv Wolfman, because Marv Wolfman was writing the John Carter stuff for what DC was doing. Yes, DC. They published John Carter in a book called Tarzan Presents Edgar Rice Burroughs' Weird Worlds. Yes, that's right. The book, I mean, I guess when you look at it, you see Weird Worlds. That's the, biggest part. But the title of the book that had Edgar Rice Burroughs' sci-fi concepts in it, John Carter and one other thing, that they split the book. It was half and half. But that's right. It was Tarzan Presents Edgar Rice Burroughs' Weird Worlds. What can we say? I mean, Tarzan was popular, and so if John Carter was going to get any kind of comic book, it was going to be on Tarzan's barefooted heels. Just, there's no other way around it. So yeah, anyway, the Weird Worlds book, it was split John Carter, and there was another feature that was a Edgar Rice Burroughs sci-fi type thing. Marv Wolfman wrote the stories, and I read one. I'll get to that in a minute, but this is what Marv Wolfman said about his work with John Carter. He loved the character. He said, but for him, quote, "The problem with DC's John Carter at the time was every time I'd start a story, I was told the book was going to be canceled, so wrap it right up. Then we were told to do another one. Then, as I'm writing it, we were told the book was being canceled, and wrap it up. The stories came out disjointed and subpar. I love the character, but sadly, only when I was at Marvel did I feel any control over what I was doing. The DC run was fun to do, but it didn't really work." And so, I think I have to agree with that. I went to a store, it's called Tom's Vintage Toys, and we will be talking more about that store on the Comic Book Time Machine, but when I was there, he had some dollar boxes, and I was looking through them, and I found a bunch of Marvel Tarzan comics, and I was tempted to start collecting Marvel Tarzan and actually include that in my experiment. I fought the temptation. I've got enough on my plate without using Marvel's Tarzan. But anyway, I did find a copy of issue number 4 of Tarzan Presents Edgar Rice Burroughs' Weird Worlds. And I read it because I wanted to see how it compares to what Marvel is doing. Last issue of John Carter, Warlord of Mars, I really, really enjoyed. And I was really, really wanting to see what happens next. So the DC John Carter, written by Marv Wolfman, written by the same guy who was writing the Marvel stuff. I just didn't like it. And there are a lot of potential reasons for this, but one thing is, as I'm looking and reading, my eye just glosses down the page. I mean, I'm reading and looking at it, and I'm just not enticed. Part of it is anatomy of the characters. I'm looking at some of the characters, and just their face shape is shaded weird or something like that, and their basic anatomy of the human characters, they do weird poses that I just can't imagine regular human beings doing. And the story, I'm just not enticed. I'm just not interested. I'm with both the Marvel comic and this DC comic, I'm starting the story just thrown into the middle of things. In the Marvel comic, I want to know what's going on. In this DC comic, I'm just not all that interested. And so I did not like the DC version. Now, it's possible that some of this comes from Marv Wolfman's experience. Like I said in the quote before, he just wasn't given a chance to really explore the stories the way he wanted to, but when he went to Marvel, he had that opportunity. And so he was able to write the stories in the way that he wanted to and present the chapters with the pacing that he wanted to. And pacing is a big thing when it comes to these kind of comics, is you want to have exciting pacing to it. Some of it also might come from Gil Kane's artwork. The style of the characters and the style of the alien creature design, I like the Marvel version. I really, really enjoy looking at the Marvel John Carter comic from a visual space pulp fantasy perspective. The creature design is cool. The costuming is interesting. It's muscular. It's the female characters, they are sensual. But the whole thing just is a perfect combination of what a pulpy fantasy series should look like. And the DC stuff, they're wearing sandals. In the Marvel stuff, they're wearing swashbuckler boots. But in the DC, they're wearing sandals. It's sword and sandal stuff on Mars. And in Marvel, I feel like I'm almost looking at like a pirate book or something. I don't know. But there's definitely a more swashbuckling vibe to the Marvel books. So anyway, in this issue of John Carter, Warlord of Mars, a lot happens. That cool three-armed green Martian, Krakus, he's dead. I wish he wasn't, because he was cool-looking and interesting. Deja Thoris is back in John Carter's arms, but a red Martian, a human, possibly Stara Khan, who was mentioned in the first issue, he's looking around, he's spying on them, and then they capture him. He doesn't speak. They put him on trial. They're going to put him to death, but he still doesn't speak. But John Carter, he's worried, because he's worried about the atmosphere machine that keeps everyone alive on Barsoom. This atmosphere machine must keep working, and if someone were to control the atmosphere machine, they would control the world. So he wants to question this guy the next day. He'll do it tomorrow. So they put him in prison, but that's just what he wanted. And we find out, this is another interesting character. Our Martian, our green Martian from last issue, who has four arms, but one was cut off. Well, this is a red Martian, and the red Martians are humanoid. Deja Thoris. Deja Thoris is a red Martian, so she looks just like a human. A very lovely, beautiful human who John Carter is in love with. So he looks like a human. He takes off his arm, and then he buries it, and then he escapes. And so John Carter, he doesn't have time to go look for that guy. The army will do that. He has to go and inspect the atmosphere factory. And he and Tars Tarkas ride their thoats, which are, you know, multi-limbed horse-like characters or creatures. And they find the factory. The doors are open. It's unguarded. No one has opened those doors in forever. John Carter is one of the few people who knows how to open it. Meanwhile, Deja Thoris, she has followed them. And so he goes inside and finds himself confronted with white apes. And those are the cool creatures that, or one of the cool creatures, that they're just these huge gorilla type things. They have extra arms. And this is the moment that the cover promised us. One Earthman battles alone against the savage white apes of Mars. Well, now it's happening. He is battling these savage white apes of Mars. The fight is quick, not as quick as the one in DC, though, and it's brutal, and it's exciting, and unfortunately, Deja Thoris, she was captured because she followed them, and now she's in the hands of the white apes, but he goes, and John Carter, he's going to go down fighting, and it ends with him killing a white ape, but they both fall off a high, I don't know what, bridge kind of thing, and they land, and John Carter is knocked unconscious. And then we find the spy, the one-armed man, who was Stara Khan. We don't know why that's important yet, but we will find out, I'm assuming, next issue. He wants to take over the factory and rule the world. Next issue, Requiem for a Warlord? Question mark. Again, I really enjoyed this. Definitely, this was worth my trip back in time to buy comics and pick up this comic off the spinner rack there at the corner drugstore. It's exciting. It's muscular. It's brutal. It's swashbuckling and interesting. And I want to find out more. I did have two problems with this, though. One big problem was that since this is an interquel and takes place between paragraphs in the first book, I think, there's no tension about the protagonist. You know, Tars Tarkas, he's off panel. You don't know what's going to happen to him with the white apes, but I'm not worried about him because he shows up in some later books. I'm not worried about John Carter at all, obviously. He's the title character. And I'm not worried about Deja Thoris. However, last issue with Krakus, the one-armed, or three-armed green Martian, I was surprised to see him die. That was interesting to me. Stara Khan, he is also interesting because he is not actually a canon character. He was created specifically for this book, this Marvel series. So those guys are more, make it more interesting and make it more exciting. Unfortunately, the other thing is, unlike last issue, in this issue I was a little more lost in the Barsoomium-ness of things. You're thrown in the middle and you're given a lot of stuff. That atmosphere factory I knew about because of the movie and some of the other things that I've read with John Carter, but I just, there's certain things about the laws of things, and I wasn't quite sure, how does John Carter fit into the whole government there? He seems to have a pretty important voice when it comes to this trial. He says, no, don't put him to death. I want to question him. And they're, okay. So I was a little lost in that, but I want to go with it, though. That's the thing, is I want to go with this, find out where this is going. I'm excited, and I am ready for issue number 3. I'm ready for the next month of Marvel Sci-Fi Comics. Which leads us to, I guess, the epilogue. Epilogue, bullpen bulletins. One of the things I plan to do with these experiments is to take a look at the, not just the ads, but the other material that you're going to find in these books. And since I'm going month by month, I'm going to be able to find, you know, the ads will be mostly the same. And if there's differences, I'll talk about that. Unfortunately, because of the way I'm reading Star Wars and John Carter, I'm not going to get the letters pages in most of those books. I really wish I could read the letters pages in Star Wars. The letter page in Star Wars issue number one was just like they did in 2001 in Logan's Run, where they're kind of explaining, this is our mission statement for this series. I'm not going to mention every ad and every little piece of copy that's not a comic book story, but I'm going to mention the ones that pop out to me. For example, there's the ad that says, "Let Joe Weider build you a better body for just $7.98. Very exciting, and I used to see these things and get very tempted because these guys look huge, man. I mean, these guys are Incredible Hulk size. And by Incredible Hulk size, I mean Lou Ferrigno, not like, you know, the Hulk from the Avengers. But this one, this next one, I was even more excited about. It says, "Make money customizing cars, vans, cycles inside and out. You can learn how to put in the bubble windows that they used to have on vans. You can put the artwork, you know, they show pictures of the like landscape artwork that they used to put on the side of customized vans. Now, this is before they were putting, I think, a lot of fantasy type stuff on there, because that, I think, came along with Star Wars and the Conan movies and stuff like that. But I found this so interesting. Start your own shop, it says. You don't even have to have any special art talent, it says. You learn inside customizing. You can customize your own van or car. I just thought this sounds so interesting. It's so cool. I'm so curious. But I'm not going to send it in because, you know, you can learn customizing for a few dollars a month. This sounds like this is like some sort of, you know, mail order course or something like that. So the other thing I wanted to mention is a small ad that was on the letters page for Logan's Run. So I don't know if it was on the letters page for the other stuff, but it's a promise for the Kirby universe. It says, "The Kirby universe explodes. Space gods, super beings, deviants tremble as they reveal their awesome secrets. In Eternals, be there every month for wonderment as only Jack Kirby and Marvel can present it." It's interesting they don't mention 2001, but they are mentioning a lot of these new concepts that Jack Kirby was coming up with for the Marvel Universe, including Machine Man. Machine Man's not mentioned here, but is one of those things that Jack Kirby was creating in this return to Marvel. So there we have it. Logan's Run has run its course. Star Wars is just beginning. 2001, unfortunately, I already know that it's kind of taking its swan song here with part three of the 2001 fan fiction by Jack Kirby. And so I'm excited for next month, and I'm excited, not next month as far as podcasting goes, but next month as far as going back in time to August 1977, where there will be more Star Wars, more 2001, more John Carter, Warlord of Mars, maybe some other stuff. I don't know. I haven't looked ahead. I just know there's no more Logan's Run in my future. So thank you very much for listening. You can go to comicbooktimemachine.com, where you can find other episodes. You can find our feeds and everything like that. And you can also contact us by sending an email to feedback@comicbooktimemachine.com. Thank you for listening again. And until next time, I don't have a better tagline than "May the Force be with you." I've got to come up with something better than that.